see the picture of what it looks like now. All right.
You guys ready?
Yes.
So let's do a little I'm going to do some introductory remarks.
Should I
and then
here?
You will sit there and I'll put this. But first, I'm going to talk for a bit.
Okay.
And then that's going to be that's going to be it. Folks, thanks for coming out. I want to just let people know what's happening here in the next month or so, and then I'll give a short introduction to Lindy and Richard. Next Sunday, the 18th, Amanda Cook, who is our education director, has got this great show at Rocky Neck called Resist. If people haven't gone there, check it out. It's get some wonderful stuff, and there's all sorts of things happening over the month. The Writers Center on the 23rd is doing a Resist Fishtails, so people will go there and tell stories that on the Friday, 5-minute stories. That's the 23rd.
Where?
Rocky Neck. And then on July 1st, in association with that same, with Amanda's show, there's going to be the Farmers Market and the Gloucester Writers Center are doing a forum, and we're bringing three people in to talk about food and the politics of food. And those people include Carolyn Mugar, who's the director of Farm Aid, Will Allen, and Niaz Dori will also be talking, and it'll be a forum at Rocky Neck. Richard Deming and Nancy Kuhl are coming here in July. On July 12th, Olivia Kate Cerrone, who was an old writer-in-residence that we have had here about 4 years ago. She came here to work on a book about the Carusi, who were children sulfur miners in Sicily in post-World War II. She finished the novella, and she's going to come here to read it, parts of it. Then we have Rick Berlin, an old Boston rocker who has a book out, who's going to be here on the 19th. And for anybody who's interested in memoir, Hetty Jones will be here on the 22nd and the 23rd to conduct a memoir class. And we still have a few slots open. So go on the website and check it out if you're interested. Go on the website, Liz. You'll find out. I can't. You know, there's a whole lot happening. There's a lot. Yeah. But it's all. You know, or go to our website. A lot of this stuff is there. All right. So tonight we're lucky to have in the room tonight two people who combine over 100 years in raising cultural awareness about literature and promoting cultural diversity. So I'll give a round of applause for Lindy and Richard. I don't know where Richard's over there lurking in the corner. Yeah. So Lindy is going to be reading first tonight. And she grew up in Denver and then came east, I assume, to go to Smith College. And there she met another young writer who was enrolled down the street, or maybe it's up the street at Amherst from Northampton. And she and this other young writer who's lurking over there in the corner there, he's certainly still young at heart, yeah, began an alternative college magazine called IO. And I just found out it was called IO because I've been always calling it EO because I thought it was the moon of Jupiter. And I guess it is. But it became a very influential literary alternative college magazine in the 60s. And it had this, as many people here know, this crazy mix of poetry and film and geography and Native American myth, alchemy, and all sorts of stuff. So with their success, they moved to Vermont in the early 70s, and the success of... What's that?
Didn't everybody move to Vermont in the early 70s?
No, I moved to Gloucester. Anyhow, so And there they founded North Atlantic Books, which was an outgrowth of their magazine. And North Atlantic Books' mission was to affect planetary consciousness, nurture spiritual and ecological disciplines, disseminate ancient wisdom, and put forth ways to transmute cultural dissonance and violence into service. And that's a hell of a mission. So thanks for your work. So part of this, the organization moved to Berkeley in 77 and continues this day as a mind, body, spirit publisher. And the IOs, is preserved in anthologies published by North Atlantic Books through the early 90s. And as an author, Lindy has produced 5 books of poetry. She's the editor or co-editor of 3 anthologies, also the author of Darling You, a post-World War II novel about a love triangle between 2 dynamic women in the early 50s and a man who loves them both. So in addition to producing a whole boatload of books, Lindy's responsible for producing some very talented children. Robin Grossinger is a historical geographer at San Francisco Estuary Institute, and Miranda July is a writer and film director. And now Lindy and Richard are neighbors up in Portland, Maine. So please welcome Lindy Huff.
So do most people stand or sit?
Whatever you like. But most people do sit.
I do.
Yeah.
And I can be close enough to this thing?
Yes, I will adjust that for you that you're good.
Right.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay. I think without the traffic, it'll be
yeah, it's much better.
Well, this is a moving occasion for me because Gloucester and Charles Olson and Garrett Lansing were hugely important in my earliest years of coming of age as a poet. And Richard and I, you know, made friends with Robert Kelly, and then through him, Kelly said, go see Garrett. And of course, Olson became central to both of our work. So to get to read here is a tremendous honor to me, and I'm very, very proud of Vincent for creating it and for Henry for creating it and doing what Vincent wanted to do, and to actually get to sleep in Vincent's house is pretty exciting. So it may seem small, but it's incredibly important to nurture these things and to fund them well, get them well funded, and you guys are working very, very hard to make it happen. And I spent some time with the annual report, and it was very interesting to read about the models and library, the party you had last year creating that, and it's terrific that it's part of your mission now to run that and to it's excellent. It's all the more stuff for people to fund, basically. Okay, so given that I started as a poet, and I, even though I've moved more recently to fiction, and I'm going to read some from a new novel, I want to read 2 fairly short poems from Wild Horses, Wild Dreams, which is a new and selected poetry, 1971 to 2010. So it was published in 2011, and by North Atlantic as part of the IO Poetry Series. It basically is 20 poems from each of the first four books, and then 20 new poems, and these are two of the newer poems. We're Not Going Home Yet. That's the title. Finding sleep, finding somewhere to go to be comfortable, a self one can live with, which meets in the dark that person you really are. The birds are voracious, eat everything put in the feeders right away. We don't even know if it's different birds or the same. Phew. We're leaving for Berkeley 10 days later than last year. I should be able to manage this, but the darkness of the woods rises up. Plummeting temperatures throw me. I buy big warm felt slippers at Walmart, haunt the thrift store, buy sweaters, warm boots. The troops come out to deal with acute loneliness. Thrown back on one's own resources, I reach down to the lake. The moon is hovering there, beginning to rise high, big, full, round, yellow. Look around. There's much to support the stranger in the wilderness. Stop the internal chiding. Compare yourself to others. Stop the internal chiding, comparing yourself to others. The small black chickadee doesn't think about his self. For 17 years, we've had a place on Mount Desert Island in Southwest Harbor, and this is called Maine Songs. The door drifts open. Cat? We left them at home. Breeze, sadness to not have them here. You can't have everything, my parents used to say, trying to impress limits on my exploratory style. Why not, I thought. Why not try for it all? I have, and have seen why limits are a good idea. Overwhelmed, we squabble and joust, stabbing the smallest things. Aware of reactivity, we seem incapable of stopping it. Picture rolling your anger up in a garland of roses, throwing it out to space, then blowing it up. That's what Berkeley Psychic Institute recommends. It would slow you down, I say, considering trying to picture how shifting gears enough to do this silly, joyful act might impede angry words rolling from my mouth like cartwheels. So, much more of the same in this. And it would be nice if you took it away, disseminate it. Okay, this, my novel is called Darlin' You, which is the last line of a Johnny Cash song called You're the Nearest Thing to Heaven, Darlin' You. Wonderful song, and I suddenly thought, that sort of encapsulates my novel very beautifully. So through it goes a couple of threads. One is Midnight Watch 1, Midnight Watch 2, Midnight Watch 3, no one on Midnight Watch. And it's a trope. It's a little poetic interlude, not so narrative driven. At midnight, the studio waited. Maybe I would say that of the three children in the book, the 10-year-old is involved in ballet, and this is the ballet studio, and what happens when all the children are gone. At midnight, the studio waited, hopeful, empty, deserted. The big lattice windows were closed for the night. And then the moon came. Moonlight slid onto the rosin floor, seeking its shimmering reflection in the huge mirrors at the front of the room, wanting, needing to see itself. Its sheen created a mysterious swirl, a ghostly presence. No small bodies sat on the stairs waiting for their first four private lessons, just the waiting studio. And now moonlight swaying, circling with its whole orb, a head on invisible shoulders and body. Watching itself dance, swirling, twisting, imagining itself a river swooping high above the mirrors, older than mountains, waiting, wanting to be a forceful presence here on earth, not distended, not at a distance. Wanting to be embodied like these children were, safe in the ballet school. Moonlight preened and arched its round body, reaching out to music only it could hear. Excited girls' voices across the generations, since the days when it was the field house of a private girls' school, stuffed with uniforms and pennies and hockey sticks, and excited girls changing for gym 20 years ago. No piano darted the air for pliés and continued banging out Mozart and Beethoven for rondejam, tendu, frappés, for complicated bar combinations on half toe involving port-de-bras, turning in toward the bar in relevés, and slow développés in high, first facing the other way, carrying the leg around to second, then a deep arabesque penché. No, none of that. Moonlight danced a sinuous samba alone, shaking itself, filling space in long, slow stretches, settling into the spell of its own movement, finding clarity in its enigmatic circularity. At its top glory, at moonrise, it was full and brightest in this dark December, closest to the sun, flooding light into the studio. She threw her arms akimbo in a wild bebop, an unheard doo-wop chorus rising up to the little room above where eight-year-old girls and boys began their four privates, or an advanced dancer alone worked on a tricky combination. Moonlight spun and ducked with herself as partner, a hoedown, a rag, a western country air playing, "Camptown ladies, sing the song, doo-da, doo-da." Camptown racetracks 5 miles long, oh, doo-da-day. I went down south with my hat caved in, doo-da, doo-da. I came back north with a pocket full of tin, oh, doo-da-day. Going to run all night, going to run all day. Bet my money on a bobtail nag, somebody bet on the bay. On the gray. The sweaty smell of dancing bodies hung in the air. The janitor, loving the moonlight, threw open all the casement windows and washed the floor with spick and span, then went below to swab the dressing room floor, swabbing the deck, as he liked to think of it, singing Louis Armstrong's Black and Blue, rough and raspy. No little girls sat on the dressing room's red costume-stuffed wooden chests, wrapping their toes in thin lamb's wool to protect against the stiff insides of toe shoes, which did little good because the lamb's wool slipped around. They held new toe shoes under the washtub faucet, bent them backwards, shut the hard, wet box in a door to soften them. The studio was closed for Christmas as girls skied with their families, forbidden by Svetlana. Last thing Svetlana want is girl lugging around leg and cast. You'll be out of whatever we're rehearsing for. Just totally out. Moonlight danced upstairs. The janitor swabbed the deck, singing softly to himself. Such a contrast from the days, weeks, months, years of striving, tension, competition, ambition, tears, shame, embarrassment and envy had sunk deep into its painted walls, hung on the mirrors and in the wainscoting behind the bars. Though sublime moments also rose like vapors off a misty forest lake when a dancer found a moment of nuanced characterization in rehearsal, or another lifted a leg to a new unshaking height in class, or propelled herself higher than ever in a flawless tourjeté. They learned, adjusted, and worked their heads off. They were not masochistic children. 10 to 16, the regularity of the bar and the center work reassured them. They put up with temper tantrums of their teacher as the price of being here, watching another's artful rendition of a combination or focusing to remember a tricky combination. They created rapturous moments when dancing was the best thing in their lives. Minefields abounded, pockets of wobbliness, the drooping foot, splayed limbs not ending on the right beat, sloppy music from Miss Lily, the pianist whose mind wandered. Anxiety boomeranged from wall to wall. Hopes fell. Confidence flagged as Madame Svetlana lashed out with a viper's tongue. Some days her stalking rants seemed endless, watching faltering extensions and flat-footed heavy fouettes. Even if a 15-year-old was dancing better than ever before, she could be thrown off, stumble, skid across the floor, to be met with a surprising laugh from Svetlana, who appreciated the pell-mell gusto. She laughed more as she aged, perhaps realizing that shaming a child to blurring tears set the whole class back. By the time her turn was over, a young girl's could be reeling, dizzy from a spin, her face red with effort. One girl complained of stomach pains. The visit to the doctor confirmed an ulcer. "How could that be?" asked the incredulous parents. "She's so young." Madame Svetlana kept mum. In class, she's all smiles, showing off their child, complimenting her profusely in front of the pleased parent. Another child tosses and turns at night, unable to hold her leg still. Moonlight doesn't know about overriding pain, tights soaked with blood from blistered toes, dried in the closet so parents won't see. A girl whispers to her friend on the bus as they do math homework, "Everyone dies of shame in ballet." "Don't take it personally. You're good. Ignore her." Another muses, "She doesn't care about us. She's a narcissist. She's always gazing at herself in the mirror. Don't you see her? She cares only about herself." "She doesn't," says another. "She loves us. That's why she's so mean." "Then let her show it. That's not love. No one who loves you would want to hurt you that much." "My dad's like that when he gets drunk. Worse." They fall silent, not knowing what to say to this. Moonlight likes the Rumba Studios and dance halls in Five Points, Avalon Ballroom in Harlem, the romantic swing big band orchestra at Elitch's, smoky Chicago jazz spots headlining Duke Ellington. Moonlight loves Peggy Lee's husky whisper at Chicago's Buttery Room. Moonlight dances by herself with no idea that anyone should watch, just wanting to move. Okay, this is the first chapter of Darlin Yu. So you can see what you think of it. First chapter is hugely important to selling a book. It's called Black Ice. In 1948, my mother died. I was 40. She was 70. She'd been a champion diver back in college in 1900 and bequeathed to me her diving dictums. The dive should be high and long, entry to the water vertical and splashless. Standing by her casket at the burial, her words streamed into me. High, long, vertical, no splash. They became one of the parts of her I could have in me. I had three daughters and a husband. The girls were 13, 11, and 5. Each morning, grief was a heavy black coat of wet feathers. I pushed hard against the waters of despair, pushing down on my head and body to struggle up and breathe. I'd been volunteering for the Junior League, the Denver Symphony, going to sewing club and fortnightly, the last where ladies my age and much older wrote and presented research papers about Denver topics to one another on subjects they found interesting. I couldn't make it to the meetings of these in the daytime once I started teaching at the Blaylock School for Brain Injured and Retarded Children. The chief attraction of this job was that I could be home for Cody, now in first grade, coming home after school. My children, the children, were severely damaged. Day after day, I plodded on, unsure if I'd be alive by the end of the month, the end of the year. Life seemed flat, hollow, and unendurable. When I spoke of my grief to a friend, she dragged me along to her introductory photography class at Denver's Opportunity School. I got home from the class and rooted among my husband's older cameras for the best one. Jeremy was a freelance journalist who wrote about oil and gas exploration in the Four Corners area for the Denver Post and Time Life, of which he was Western Bureau Chief. He turned an old wine cellar into a darkroom he wasn't using. The places he wrote for developed his film, and it was all mine, he said. High, long, vertical, entry, splashless. I repeated to myself these words as my images in the developing trays took shape in their watery baths. Let this be good. I rooted for the image to appear and astonish me. At this moment, the family of man was being pulled together. My teacher, Hattie Langlois, was excited about American social realism. She'd just returned from New York, where she'd seen the exhibit of the humanist group at the Museum of Modern Art's post-war European photography exhibit. Hattie showed us the work of Dorothea Lange, the Depression-era documentary photojournalist, famous for her work showing the plight of sharecroppers, displaced farmers, migrant workers in the Dust Bowl. We studied Walker Evans, Edward Steichen. She made us an assignment based on what was going out for photographers to respond to. It was called A Summons to Photographers All Over the World, calling on them to reveal by visual images man's dreams and aspirations, his strength, his despair under evil. If photography can bring these things to life, this exhibition will be created in a spirit of passionate and devoted faith in man. Nothing short of that will do. How many of you know about the Family of Man collection of photographs? The book was published in the early 50s. The goal was to enlarge the awareness of others to combat the isolationism and xenophobia of the Cold War. In 1950, the U.S. was still reeling from the discovery of the Jews in extermination camps and World War II. Barbara Walker, one of the Family of Man photographers, wrote in Aperture, "Empathy with these hundreds of human beings truly expands our sense of value." Hattie wanted us to do a smaller version, three series of people caught in emotional moments, children, grandparents, rich and poor, all different types of people. Unclear how I was to go on living without my mother, I embraced the assignment. My three series were images of young boys dangerously throwing themselves on crazed bulls at the Great Western Stock Show in Denver, Cody and her friends in ballet class and at Red Rocks rehearsing for Sleeping Beauty amid tears, striving, relentless competition, and my students at Blaylock stumbling around in the stark plains of Bloomfield, playing on the blacktop, trying against severe odds. Life magazine, how am I doing? Life magazine ran an article that Rebecca, our my protagonist here, saved and studied about physicists brought over from Europe to create the Manhattan Project. European couples were photographed working in their gardens, shopping in the commissary, going to the hairdresser on site, entertaining on their flagstone porches, the wives with cute pageboy or gamin haircuts in sandals and petal pushers or flowered dresses, the nuclear physicist husbands designing atomic weapons, and the very secret, no more, hydrogen bomb in rolled up jeans in Bermuda shorts, serving minty mojitos and margaritas, smoking, chatting. They couldn't go off the base. Poker on Saturday nights, square dancing Fridays, Navajo rugs on the walls of their small adobe houses, a sort of unusual army base. Los Alamos. Hungry for more than photography, for art per se, I became a docent at the Denver Art Museum two Saturdays a month, leading people through a major two-month-long touring exhibit on Dada and Surrealism. I read out loud to my groups from the Dada Manifesto by Franco-Romanian avant-garde poet and performance artist Tristan Zara. I say unto you, this is quoting him, there is no beginning and we do not tremble, we are not sentimental. We are a furious wind, tearing the dirty linen of clouds and prayers, preparing the great spectacle of disaster, fire, decomposition. We will put an end to mourning and replace tears by sirens screeching from one continent to another. Pavilions of intense joy and widowers with the sadness of poison. Dada is the signboard of abstraction. Advertising and business are also elements of poetry. I destroy the drawers of the brain and of social organization, spread demoralization wherever I go, and cast my hand from heaven to hell, my eyes from hell to heaven, restore the fecund wheel of a universal circus to objective forces and the imagination of every individual. Every time I read this, as a docent to my group, my groups, a chill went up my spine. Listen to that, I proclaimed to them. The energy from Dada leaping decades, seeping into my body. We are a furious wind, tearing the dirty linen of clouds and prayers. Picture this, 1918, Zurich, Switzerland. World War I has ended. Zara and his friends are pushing beyond the nationalism and post-war materialism which followed the war, challenging painting and sculpture to wake up, to move beyond cubism, industrial Russian futurism, expressionism. Zara's new movement is Dada. In French, that means hobby horse. It's the word French children use for giddy up, Dada, let's go, get a move on. And then more about Dada, how it used found objects, tiny pieces, bits and pieces. No longer was art about creating aesthetically pleasing objects with decorum. Instead, mylar plastic, small toy animals, basically making collages. It was the first moment where you didn't have the canvas frame defining what you were going to do. Were they trying to criticize society through art? Inquired an earnest woman in a gray felt hat. Yes, social criticism was encouraged. The artist should use his or her work to speak out about society, materialism, government, the culture, to upend, he said, meaning don't be afraid of upsetting the status quo. It was a truly populist art. I explained how Dada paved the way to surrealism, influencing the poet André Breton, the painters René Magritte, Man Ray, Max Ernst, Salvador Dali. It died a quiet death in 1924, I said. Its goal is completed. Art had been loosened up. One day, the head curator of the show walked by and paused, watching my delivery. "That was very nice, Rebecca," she said afterwards as we were closing. "He showed real feeling for the work. They looked enthralled." She didn't know the half of it. Bitten by Dada, I scurried home and converted my basement photography studio into a more general art space, with bins for found objects, fabrics, natural objects I gathered on walks. I built assemblage, created collages, hammered sculptural pieces together with wires and nails and wood. Chance reckoning. Instead of being occupied with light and shadow, I channeled my thoughts into this work. Out came my fury about the state of the country. The horrid Cold War Red Scare with its ongoing buildup of weapons. Our rivalry with the Soviet Union. Out came my anger at Senator Joe McCarthy calling up government workers on a daily basis in Washington to testify about their, quote, communist ties, labeling all kinds of people left-wing loyalty risks, naming union leaders communist stooges or spies. Jeremy, my husband, and I had a friend who'd been tried and convicted in a kangaroo court, then imprisoned in Colorado Springs as a communist spy, who had never had any communist connections at all. Writers, New York Hollywood actors, screenwriters, theater directors, homosexuals, and musicians had to testify about supposed communist or socialist leanings. Among the business magazines Jeremy brought home from work was the weekly yellow newsletter of the Nevada Proving Grounds atomic bomb sites tests. It became fodder for collages. Now they were working on the H-bomb so big they couldn't test it. He took photos for Uranium, his magazine that he just started, of Navajos, Hopi, Ute, Zuni men working uranium mines for Los Alamos, as miners, timber men building the supports for the mines, blasters, muckers, crushers, transporters, and millers. He discarded prints he wasn't using, and I picked them out of the trash, or got his negs and printed more. They funneled into the three-dimensional assemblage and collages. These were proud, unsmiling men exposed to uranium dust. Uranium mining provided jobs for impoverished Indians, Jeremy said, the only jobs on the reservation. But why not, I said to him, urged that mine owners are responsible for installing ventilation in their mines in uranium. That'd be the old bouncer-oo, kid, he'd say. Uranium would go kaput. You know who paid for this dishwasher, he said, gesturing to the new round silver standalone dishwasher. Subscribers, Pumpkinhead, including mine owners. They're not to be trifled with. I studied the Navajo beauty way to counter how scared I was, and attempted to tame my downbeat fear with this graceful spiritual path, chanting, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty around me, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty around me. As I worked the designs and myths of Navajo sand paintings and weavings, described by Gladys Reichard, into my work. Upset by Hiroshima and our society's silence about the discovery of the Jews in the concentration camp 7 years earlier, images of both found their way into my work. Some pieces spit pure anger. A tiny sampler pilot flew into a massive purple spray-painted mushroom cloud. In several sad dioramas, Japanese ate outdoors at their picnic table in an internment camp, did laundry, played ball. One of my best friends came for lunch. I led her downstairs to see the work. She moved slowly around the studio, looking thoughtfully at the pieces. And then she cocked her head and said, "Well, Rebecca, this is a litany of horror. But you know, I think I get it. Silence becomes fear. Silence reinforces and it cooperates. Your work is beautiful, though some of it has the subtlety of a battering ram. Maybe it'll wake people up." We walked up the stairs, and my heart soared at the unexpected praise. Thank you.
So, if you thank you, Wendy, for that reading. By the way, as you see, there's a mountain of books over there. After the reading, check them out. And Richard and Lindy said that if you're interested in them and you want to pay pay for them, they're 50% off. But if you don't have what it takes to pay for half of them, please give what you can. And there's a bowl there for that. So. Of course, yes. A native in Manhattan, Richard Grossinger attended Amherst College and University of Michigan. He got a degree in a BA in English and a PhD in anthropology. And he wrote his doctoral thesis on his field work with fishermen in eastern Maine. After that, he taught 2 years at Maine at Portland Gorham and 5 years at Goddard College in Vermont. His work includes experimental prose and books on holistic medicine, pop culture, contemporary politics, cosmology, embryology, and he's also written a couple of memoirs. Out of Babylon is one that I found pretty fascinating because it explores the sort of unique culture of the Borscht Belt, along with Richard growing up in a family that had a kind of a concern happening out there. But lastly, another personal footnote is that these guys, they published sort of my son's favorite childhood book called Walter the Farting Dog. So, you know, if any of you have grandchildren that need an interesting and funny book, that's one to check out. Tonight he's going to read from Episodes in Disguise of a Marriage and the bottoming out of the universe, karma, reincarnation, and personal identity. And Episodes is the second volume of nonfiction literary trilogy.
Richard.
Do you want that bottle of water? Would
nope.
you like it for yourself?
Here.
Because you can have it.
Yes, well, as for Lindy, for me, it's really special to read here. The Gloucester and Charles Olson's work was at the core of my own evolution as a writer. I want to reiterate what Henry said. The books are there hopefully to be taken, so just if you want one, don't let any amount of cost stand in the way. Just leave something and take whatever book you want. My work is kind of in two pieces, although they do converge, as they would have to. The bigger part of my work is writing about certain subject matter, holistic health, astronomy, cosmology, biology, embryology, and consciousness. And those are represented by the books there. And I also have worked over my entire life on what has become a three-volume novel, nonfiction novel, somewhere halfway between a memoir and a novel. The first volume, I published two of the volumes in the 90s and then realized that they were published prematurely and then took them apart. I've republished one of them, not Out of Babylon, but New Moon, which is it's the story of growing up, and it goes up to the point at which Lindy and I kind of met and began together. The one volume that I never published because it was too personal, I named in the 70s Episodes in Disguise of a Marriage and assumed I'd never publish it. And then I worked on it a bit in the 90s on the same assumption. And then really only 3 years ago did I decide to commit to seeing if I could write it. I still haven't decided whether it's something that can be published. And it's about Lindy and me and our relationship. It's the direct sequel to New Moon. And the third book, Out of Babylon, is about my family and larger generational sweep of the family. If anybody wants to read Episodes, I'm glad to send anybody a copy of the draft file as an email it to them. If you've read New Moon, if you tell me, I will believe you and send it. Because I don't know when or if I'll publish it. I'm working on one book in the other genre, and I'll read one short section of it. It's online. I every time I work on it, I repost it online. It's called Bottoming Out the Universe. That alternately could be called Not Dumbing Down the Universe. And the subtitle is, Reincarnation, Karma, and Personal Identity, which I think are the three big ones. And because that's on my website, you can read that. And I'll read this one little image from it. While writing this text, June 7th, 2015, I found a beetle in a goop of tamari and maple syrup with which I had cooked string beans with pecans earlier. It was crawling among a few stray beans and nuts as I began to wash the dishes and pans. Obviously, I hadn't cooked the beetle, so it must have wandered in by crawling up the slippery side of the porcelain serving dish while we and our guests were having tea. I managed to extricate it by flipping it onto its back on the counter. Watching it flail in distress, I tried gently to wash off the sticky sauce. That was misguided help, or maybe the creature's fate was already determined. I am haunted by those prickly thin legs waving, trying to gain purchase and locate. I silently told it not to be in a hurry. That is, I dispatched my anthropomorphism its way. Only as I took its motionless shell out to the herb garden and set it there, did it strike me that those fragile legs, those frantic legs, were connected to the universe in the same way everything is, and that at a deeper subtlety, I was handling a humongous hologram, sensing not a separate bug, but my own existence in relation to and inseparably joined to it. It was not a minor event to the beetle. The whole universe was flailing at its point of attachment. It was not minor to the universe either. Now I'm going to try and read from Episodes in Disguise of a Marriage, which I have to say takes a certain amount of courage, as you'll say. But I don't think that what I want, the piece I care about most reading is from the very end of the book. The book is as long as New Moon, which is, I think, 680 pages. So you have to realize you've been through a lot to this point. And in New Moon, Robert Kelly is an incredibly central character in helping Lindy and me sort of discover each other, stay together, provide images that we used in our early years of our relationship, images we had to overcome. And I really, Kelly hardly appears in episodes. He pops up now and again. But then, as I come to the end of it, I go all the way back to that issue. Robert Kelly proposed many things. I want to say I abridged this, too. I cut it by half to make it work for this. Robert Kelly proposed many things in his time with us. Most of it was new and shocking and invaluable to two 20-year-olds. This was heavy stuff. Shekinah, alchemical matrimony, angelic doubles. But he seemed to betray his own sacraments with compulsive rigor as he sexualized and propositioned women unabashedly, often young students or recent former students, living with and marrying a few of them along the way. In 1972, when he held a visiting professorship at Caltech in Pasadena, he invited Lindy and me to visit him and read from our work there. His acolyte, Harvey Bialy, was also staying in the Kelly household with his then-wife, Timitha, both former Bard students. That Kelly had lusted after Timitha, or for that matter, Lindy, was no secret. He hid it like Poe's purloined letter, in plain sight, with lines and gestures so provocatively lascivious that they came off as parodies of themselves. Sometimes he acted upon them. He was that good of a Lothario, an erotic priest, the smoothest talker in the Milky Way. For Christ's sake, he was a poet about whom it was written that words flocked to him like birds to Assisi. No wonder young women, too, were drawn by the mage for absolution. Kelly had one thing right. The alchemical marriage is as coarse and rude and tawdry as the blood and reptile chemicals that flow through our tissues. There is no temple on earth made solely of sanctimonies and prayers. Lust is the gateway, because lust is how deep into itself the universe's latency had to go to get a response as robust as a flood of star systems, with spiraling orbs and moons about suns, with seeds and eggs. Lust denied or repressed closes all gateways, even stars. Find a way to honor lust that does not dishonor the responsibilities and priesthoods lodged in men and women, their humanity and troth as sentient beings. That is the enigmatic task. One morning in Pasadena, Timitha came downstairs for breakfast in her nightgown, and Kelly wondered aloud what pulling the string would do. Timitha said, "Why don't you pull it and see?" It didn't go beyond the pulling, and nothing notable happened. But even that disclosure, that collaboration between older man and younger woman, was tacky to Lindy and me, and made us want to flee, which we did. Kelly and his scene for the next three decades. But we fled only into our own initiations, which had the same demons, the same sphinx, the same sirens, male and female. And on the other side, we discovered the truth that Robert was teaching. Teaching by violating. Teaching by teaching. And violating because violation was the teaching. You find the alchemical wedding by destroying it, by transmuting its niceties and fine garments, by consigning them and yourself to a flame that consumes and redeems all things. The erotic field is finally the soul field, operating at a denser, gamier vibration, the gunk of the hermetic vessel. Desire exists because there is no other path, no other sign, no guide through the communion and the haze. Nothing but dead reckonings in a sea too vast and tenebrous to gauge. An alchemical wedding is devious and uncompromising, though one doesn't know that at the outset, because it is devious in every regard, including its premise. Alchemy is not harmony, It is a dialectic of minerals and cardinal elements. Marriage didn't end our disparities. We flared up again and again in our hothouse. Far from progressing towards the resolution of antitheses, we proved that certain matters cannot be resolved. We elevated them to ontologies and we lived them. Though her God was born in an Episcopal church and mine in fairy tales, belief in the divine turned into belief in love, romantic love, sacred love. We read that in each other from the get-go. Not Christ of the Catholic Church, but the Christic vibration, a holy source code. The vows we recited before a Denver judge on Franklin Street were ritualized words, but they were true. In good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. They echoed our heritage, the stars up above, it's always you. Alone we were two vagrant tarot cards, together we were the lovers, Trump 6, seeing God through seeing each other. Kelly activated a truth. Its meaning resonated in our auras beyond our mind's sight. A Hebrew and Celt in light cast by an ancient order preceding the Ice Age migrations. Atlantean and Lemurian or DNA-derived haplogroups that yielded synagogues and churches. The dirge-like chords of the Stone Ponies ballad Long, Long Time inadvertently capture a deeper mystery as sex and love wrap in interchangeable faces around its melody. And I never drew one response from you, all the while you fell all over girls you never knew. It's an old song, Linda Ronstadt song. Lindy and I may have claimed each other from the beginning, but we did it unknowingly through fantasies and proxies, churning up surrogates before we got to our own essence. Loss followed each time by innocent romance. The girl in made up blue eyes and pigtails on Mary Street in Ann Arbor was beautiful, but her beauty got in the way. Another life is so complex that it is hard to grasp. In fact, you don't. It comes at you in bits and pieces, fits and starts, each of them larger than a whole planet. It took a long time to absorb something so profound, so subtle, so intrinsically spiritual, the existence of an imponderable being living alongside me. We were overwhelming to each other from the moment we locked orbits, too big to comprehend, the manifold layers and facets, gyrations of personae and personalities. Each of our natures was eclipsed by concourse with the other's continually emerging form. I had to assimilate her nuances of style and texture, which added up to greater charm and more discreet and individual beauty. Why did I have one of the worst panics of my life, certainly the most sustained one, after beginning my relationship with Lindy on a green leaves of summer night at Phi Psi? My guess is that my aura and soul read her aura and soul, the vibe of this new being, and realized what it was in for if it proceeded. She read my aura too, and made a decision at a soul level to take on my karmic chain. It served her evolution. No, she wouldn't have just blown in any boy's ear. She liked me because I didn't flirt. She could express subtler forms of eros without getting back male fuss and pursuit. She needed a boy she could shape, who didn't think he knew it all, but he had to interest her enough for her to want to take him on. She didn't want to be Pygmalion, so I had to be more than Galatea. I was. I'm the narrator of this tale. By blowing in my ear, she brought the narrator to life. Yet as editor of its text, she resists another inflation tossed her way. She edited this book, so her edits are in it. And she said, "This doesn't get you anywhere. I thought we were equal travelers on a journey." We were. But in my version, she woke me up at 19 and made me live my life for real, something I only imagined I was doing then. I was a basic, limpid boy, complex psychologically and intellectually, artless emotionally, a mesmerized starfish. Yet the starfish ended up with a dancing crab, a prancing pony, a lady of unimpeachable style who was the Lindy Hop of her name, a discriminating writer of emotional depth, a poet whose lines had force, poignancy, and unpredictable breaks of a modern dancer. I couldn't see her. She was the fantasy figure in the flesh, the goddess I could never have but always had, the woman beyond reach who lived within and with me, the most perfectly ecstatic thing I had ever experienced. Seeing Lindy in our 60s and 70s with beginner's eyes was like meeting her in the doorway of Laura Scales' house at Smith College in 1963, or walking into Northampton with her that first time. It was the spring dance when, for the first time, I hailed a regal girl who received my life and offered me hers, who gave me the ultimate gift, her own classic beauty in a stately, chivalrous manner, and her days on earth. We would do the dance many times and in as many ways as it took to complete a chemical ceremony in this diabolically ecstatic zone. But that's how labyrinths work. I'm going to cut a bridge further here in order to not have this one piece dominate the whole thing. The 12 stages of alchemy correspond to the 12 signs of the zodiac, Aries to Pisces. They are calcination, digestion, fermentation, putrefaction, congelation, coagulation, fixation, serration, distillation, sublimation, filtration, solution, multiplication, and projection. The first three impose decomposition and separation. The second three modify and transmute. The third trio separates and sublimates. The last set completes the metamorphosis in a new union, the philosopher's stone. A drier golden powder or black stone with glowing striations mark the final stage of transmutation after the dark bath and clarification. As antimony becomes gold in the chemist's alembic, the lower personality and baser self are mixed in union with a purified astral body. Lindy and I were too young and raw at the calcination phase. We had to be heated in a crucible or over a fire until we became ashes. You burn up your chemistry or you kindle it alchemically. Same ingredients, different process. Some fermentations take weeks or months, others a year or two. Some come and go in a matter of seconds, but they are no less real in a universe of 200 billion galaxies, each congregating thousands of millions of stars. From the beginning, we are not educated for this ceremony. We are not prepared for the dance. We are not taught to see the wedding. The materialist corruption of every commodity corrodes the most precious of all. There is no formula for the crucible, and we did pretty much everything that was counterindicated. That's how we got here. There is no rule book, and if there was, we broke every rule. And if we hadn't, we never would have found each other or been able to stay together long enough to experience our own transparency. That's what I work toward at the end. It's backwards. Most of the book, more of the book is trouble. So here's some trouble. So. Early after our move to Berkeley, a feisty nurse who played in the games at Cordonesis, these were pickup softball games, invited me to go sailing. I'd say this is about age 32 or so. I had noticed Nancy as a rare lady in the game. About 6 years younger than me, she had intelligent features and a pout, like dozens of girls I had eyed in summer camp and at college mixers. Judging fly balls and swatting occasional line drives gave her a personality. She was a cat-like thing with tomboy grace, a better player than many of the guys. I assumed naively that my having brought my kids to the games meant that she knew I was married. As she steered our tiny skiff around the bay, she was chagrined to hear about my partner at home. She had assumed I had custody on weekends. Nuclear families were changing so rapidly that if you weren't in the mix, you were out of the loop. Our sail was a marginally fraught outing in a stiff breeze. I was mainly relieved that I didn't get motion sick or drown, that she didn't turn out to be a succubus who dumped men in the bay. My paranoid imagination was reminding me I didn't know a thing about her beyond the ball field. Back at her place, a room rented from a cryonics institute with a spooky white refrigeration truck parked in front. She admitted thinking romance would follow the sale, but had reconsidered. I hadn't foreseen sex, at least beyond quotidian male susceptivity. I'd assumed that sailing meant sailing, that she was a teammate, one of the guys who had a boat. Intimacy on the water had built erotic charge. Camaraderie often does, though most venues are inconvenient or inappropriate for acting or admission. Sexual tension goes unacknowledged at workplaces, in mundane gatherings, or between ineligible members of couples. Nancy and I dawdled in awkwardly equivocal agendas on the edge of her bed, the only couch. She looked me over with a playfully licentious grin and with stark candor declared, "Under the circumstances, sleeping together is too big an investment, too much muss and fuss. I'd prefer something else." She coyly put her hand on my shoulder and shifted her weight toward me, suggesting silently I should lie back. She undid my belt, pulled off my pants and underpants, left to make the sound of running water in the sink, and returned with a warm washcloth. She rinsed my penis and took it in her mouth. Just like that, she was deft and methodical, about 1 minute from her last spoken words to sucking off. I'd imagined a fair trade, apples for apples. Instead, I got a koan, the sound of one hand clapping. My gesture to reciprocate, either before or during, was brushed aside as an imposition. For whatever reason, she found it more satisfying to waive her own orgasm and control my pleasure. Perhaps it was jaded accession to male libido from unhappy experience, though she was avid and assertive with a dominatrix-like zeal. I found it amazing that she could just do that to me, that I could be transformed so rapidly in the company of another being who was exploring a different mystery in herself. Guiltily, I savored every phase, from the brief prodrome to her near presence and touch, the gentleness of her hand guiding a warm, wet terry cloth, the distinctive way she ran her tongue over me. Like the nurse she was in her professional life, she conducted an impeccable operation, afterwards going back to refresh the washcloth and then wash more tenderly. As she drew me toward epiphany in my own body-mind, I was reminded of playwright Murray Mednick's line, "Time, the eternal blowjob, you never come, she never lets go." We sat together amiably back in the space-time continuum, but we had conducted a hermetic act with no way to acknowledge it or its sacredness. It was as cryonic as the building, and true to Murray's metaphor, you don't ever come, she doesn't ever really let you go. This blowjob by an unlikely accomplice was a throwback to my adolescent masturbation fantasies. I was guided then by female images, in teenage years the incubi of my imagination. The feelings they evoked were inscrutable and cathartic. Ejaculation from my own phallus wand transformed something indescribable and ineluctable, a girl fantasized, into something else, tangible and just as mysterious and made of the same sensations. Like alchemical mercury, sperm was a seed, consciousness epitomized, yet fashioned by ordinary carbon, hydrogen, and ribonucleic molecules from freshman biology, the same gel that shoots out of spasming frogs. An otherwise bland ballad popularized by crooner Andy Williams captured the essence of the sacrament for me in 1959. Erotic power flowed beneath the dulcet blandness of the hymn, melding the sexual and divine in a single current. The song was about Lourdes, the miracles performed there, a matter I hardly understood or cared about at age 15. My ignorance freed me to hear the melody, its reverent, pensive beat, and lyrics as something else, a translocation of my fantasies to their mystical source. And the words went, I've traveled far, the land and sea, wonderful places I've happened to be. One little town I'll never forget is Lourdes, the village of Saint Bernadette. It had no explicit meaning for me. It was L's, D's, a B, and some N's in harmony. A ship at sea, a wanderer in medieval towns, I adhered in wonder through crescendo and apotheosis. There, like a dream, this wonderful night, I gazed at the grottos aglow in the light. A feeling divine swept over me there. I fell to my knees as I whispered the prayer. It couldn't have been, I wish I could sing, but I can't carry a tune. It couldn't have been more lucid, blatant, exquisite. I fell to my knees as I whispered the prayer. That was what I imagined jacking off. I never caught the phrase wonderful night, hearing instead a mondegreen, wonderful pronine, which for meaning nothing meant everything that language couldn't express. The song brought together the awe and sacredness I felt, alone with my fantasy. The swell of desire, the yearning for itself to be answered inside an imaginary girl's field. Such was sex for an otherwise virginal teenager. Maudlin and adolescent, disquieting and weird, but is anyone undergoing life on earth holding a better card or a different hand? Addiction to these forms is absolute, as many an enraptured and ruined guru or politician will attest. They are ancient mariners all in the gaze of Circe, men leering frozenly at strippers on a pole, stuffing money into their thongs, are trying to negotiate that wonderful pronine, gusts of cosmic energy from beyond this plane. Yes, what fuels infatuation is the desire to get out of oneself and be touched and unraveled by what is strange, to be met and known by the other, to assuage curiosity about another's body and sexuality. Ask Eliot Spitzer what he saw in Ashley Alexander Dupre, and he probably wouldn't sound like the articulate criminal lawyer he otherwise was. She was a thoroughly ordinary statuary of XX chromosomes and female cells, daughter of a salesman of surfing accessories, apparently not that bright or sexy, hardly worth risking everything, family, career, governorship of the New York State, reputation as a prosecutor of white-collar crime and securities fraud, admiration in the eyes of the public. But that's how powerful the other is. The shadow, the call girl, the allure of the unattached genome with its renegade DNA. Rationally, Miss Dupre wasn't worth it, but tell that to the Cambrian endospores and eukaryotes in our lineage, and they will answer, without the other, you cannot create life. I don't know if I've used up my time here or should. I have one more piece, and what do you think? Should I bring out the hook if you need to? This is I'm working my way back in the book. This is a little essay I put in the middle. In between a couple of sections. I meant to say, by the way, that this entire book, I would not mention this except in this venue. This whole book is written under an epigraph from Olson, and it just seems perfect for this book. I've had to learn the simplest things last, which made for difficulties. The free love trope of the 70s provided a portal, Eros is friendship as communion and spiritual exercise. The counterculture was courageous in its optimism, innocence, and commitment to harmonious communities and nonviolent agendas. Despite people's innate competitiveness and disparities, we fell into collaboration. We shared a lexicon of beliefs about ourselves and the world, the translation of 50s nostalgia and romanticism into embracing those yearnings and infatuations at their frequency and source. Johnny Maestro crooning, "I fell in love with you on a perfect night in June, and darling, I thank the moon," became the summer of love. When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will guide the planets and love will steer the stars. Alternative lifestyles accorded not only free speech, free schools, and environmental and anti-war tropes, but the specialness of desire and service in a magical cosmos. At Lama, a commune founded by Ahad Cobb and Baba Ram Dass in San Cristobal, New Mexico, folks gathered under the stars where they sang, "Praise God for the light within me." We were kind and gentle with each other. Praise God, let love abide. During a stretch of the 70s, people bid themselves to an Aquarian script of forbidden intimacies and carnal knowledge. Maps of 70s counterculture marked the range. Woodstock, Ant Farm, Big Rock Candy Mountain, Total Loss Farm, Liberation News Service, Goddard College, hippie caravans passing through Hopi mesas, the Summertown, Tennessee Farm, the Hate, the Diggers, Set, Io, San Francisco Oracle, Invisible Circus. They expected everything. The theme from Hair, inflated and corny, spoke a truth more plainly than we could hear or enact. What did it mean for love to steer the stars? Through the passage from tier to tier of an energy Wilhelm Reich called orgone, creatures experience erotic ecstasy and procreate their kind. On biologically endowed worlds, they inseminate and give birth in coital and embryogenic spirals triggered by supergalactic ones. As galaxies yearn gravitationally and by nucleosynthesis to meld and superimpose orgone streams, men and women express a congruent urgency to fuse currents of life force. Folks were talking about a procession of the zodiac into utopian society. The moment quickly passed, for too much had to change from the roots. Free love and the light morphed into hypersexually dissociated acts paired with a tightening of the precepts of monogamy. Deeper taboos and agendas asserted themselves on both sides of the dialectic. Bodies became naked in a whole other way. One era ended and another began that looked just like it, but was its emotional and spiritual antithesis. The discrepancy went unrecognized for a long time. The summer of love faded. Generosity and idealism met their own internal contradictions. Shadows hijack sex as they camouflage themselves in its trousseaus. Hippie chicks turned into pole ballerinas. Folks began pimping themselves and their beloveds. The pornography, hard drugs, foursomes, and commodity sex of the 80s and 90s were no longer ingenue attempts to bust out, but the capitalist annexation of free love. Spiritual depth was wrung out. Everything marketable about bodies and desires was gradually slotted into its place, as though it was not only a fair and lawful swap, but an improvement because the same acts were made even more available, explicit, and meticulously lascivious. Cabals raced one another to convert the mysteries of love into something tangible and sellable, more enticing than what the competition was offering. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Customers may have felt the emptiness and shallowing, but that led to stuffing in more action, paying for raunchier, more transgressive acts. Barker's spiced up the product with debauchery, kink, pedophilia, snuff rituals, satanic butchery, conflations of lust with violence, carnage, and power. They set up shop in the dark zones of an emerging internet. The plan was to suck the marrow out of elephant tusks and rhino horns and give everyone what they wanted in place of failed lecheries and unrequited romances. Sex was no longer a touchstone. It was, as playboys and a few existential philosophers proposed all along, fucking to its own ends. Elephants and rhinos were discarded as collateral damage. Man had beaten his oldest tormentor, female allure, with the same ingenuity with which he had defeated every other sacred object, including Earth itself. If love was going to steer the stars, it would have to convert its own shadows. Let's see. I just want to read the conclusion to this. When I write about the 70s, I am recalling a time that was categorically different from the stuff since. Yes, polyamory and scat have existed in some form since the dawn of our species. People have loved, used, and violated each other in all body shapes and epochs in imaginable and unimaginable fashions. Authentic free love evolved into the aughts, but its cultural context shifted along with accompanying ideologies and lifestyles. Acts cannot escape being acts of their time. Holistic medicine, permaculture, and food as consciousness did flourish. Mystic crystal revelation and the mind's true liberation. But sex was more difficult because it was the only product that contained its own teleology and endgame, hence could be used to sell anything else. A distinction between free love in the 70s and its equivalent in subsequent eras is hard to get across to our kids, who after they came of age regarded us as some sort of promiscuous hippies or unfaithful partners they declared they would never emulate. They saw our liaisons, to the degree that we were careless enough to reveal them, through the lens of the era in which they came of age, which made them appear not only licentious, but sentimentally kitschy, by comparison with their more punkish immaculacy. A wistful interlude began as Dream Lover and Earth Angel. We heard Do You Believe in Magic, Love is All Around, and Heart of Gold. Like all dreams, it was real whilst we dreamed it, a fairy's frolic once we awoke. What followed, of course, was a dream too. The Hardy Boys placed a sinister signpost before the 50s, but we hardly saw it as children or grokked what it was. They tried to say the broken blade, the melting coins, the secret panel, the phantom freighter, the hidden harbor, the tower treasure, the clue in the embers. The names themselves made it into the next century, along with deconsecrated editions of the books. But the titles meant something occult and magical in the 50s that the words can no longer say, that were abandoned in the Reagan era without the mysteries being solved. For the same reason, Harry Potter and a host of cyborgs and superheroes are shamanic scatology by comparison to Middle Earth, Narnia, and Earthsea. Thank you. That's it.
People have, I don't know if you guys want to answer questions or just break up and do it.
Either way.
And talk.
I just wonder how a person lives being able to analyze that well where he's come, where he went, and where we are. It's almost, it seemed like it would be so hard to be there, to see it all so well.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
When I look at, of course, what you do yourself seems normal, but I was stuck in psychoanalysis at age 8 and was in it until I went to college. And I also come from a family in which my mother, brother, and sister all committed suicide. So that, which is a lot what one of the books in the trilogy is about. And that forces you to ask questions.
Of course.
And then the world that I share with Garrett and many of these other writers here is a world of magical inquiry. And I feel as though I've learned from really great teachers how to witness.
How to witness.
Yeah.
Oh, it's interesting because I was reading the back of one of your books, Des, St. John the Victor, and it says that you involve the integral studies. And is that Ken Wilber and his group out in California?
I think it's more that Brian Swim, who teaches at Cal Institute of Integral Studies, wrote a blurb for me. So it's not quite the same thing.
Okay.
But I find that my, not this work, but my other work, my more consciousness-oriented work, is both liked by some Wilber people and hated by other Wilber people. I'm different in that I'm interested in the same stuff, but I don't care about making systems.
Yeah. Well, you do blend it because, I mean, I spend time in Sedona 6 months, and I'm doing Tibetan Buddhism, A Course in Miracles, and on Saturday mornings I go to the Integral Studies group, and it's incredible. I mean, I know his theories, and one of the books I found that introduced me to him was No Boundaries at the Rockport Dump. It's that big, but it's fantastic.
It's a dump.
So, a lot of the people, like there was a man named Terry Patton, I don't know if you know him, he's a teacher with Wilber, and Wilber is still alive, and he's a contemporary, one of the best philosophers today, they say. But your work does reflect integrating all of that, you know.
I also would call attention to a teacher that I found, all my teachers are peer teachers rather than gurus, but John Friedlander, who's a Harvard Law School graduate who became a professional psychic teacher in Ann Arbor. I've been studying with him, and he teaches a mixture of, it's a beautiful blend of theosophy, Blavatsky theosophy, with the Seth material, because he was with Jane Roberts when she channeled Seth, with Dzogchen Buddhism, which he studied. He's merged them all together in this amazing active system that, you know, I could go on about, but not here.
Did Robert Kelly go to Indiana or teach there? Because I was in a poetry group, I think, that he led in Indiana in 65.
Well, I don't know.
Did you mention knowing him?
Yeah, he could have. He didn't teach there on a long-term basis, but he could have appeared there.
Mm-hmm. Are you a futurist, too?
No. I hope not, if I know what that means. I'm not interested in technology that much.
It's just that as you reviewed my life, too, evidently, I recognized all of it. But do you see where we're going when you say I'm not into technology? Do you think that's where it's going to end up? Everything is going to just be technology? Man.
No, in that way, I'm not a futurist. I think that in the face of every reason to be pessimistic, I think that the best reason for optimism is that we're here, and that sometimes we forget what an accomplishment that is. And I don't just mean Darwinian evolution, although that's a reflection of it on this plane. But I mean, I think what an enormous spiritual undertaking for the universe to create this reality. And so I don't think that it's a discardable reality. I think that whatever happens in it, and obviously in these Trump times and all the rest, Trump, ISIS, and so forth, but that's all being created by the same exquisite design of reality that we're working through right now. And so I'm optimistic in that sense. Yeah.
I thought that Eliot Spitzer passage nailed all those words to a present reality in a most profound way. I thought that was really a terrific piece of that.
Thank you, yeah. I know, sometimes it just comes to you. That came to me when I was walking with my cousin in Central Park on a visit to New York, and he walked by Elliot Spitzer, and my cousin, who's a staunch Republican, still smiled and said, "Hi, Governor."
But you can replace Elliot Spitzer with so many other people.
Yeah, I mean, he just was a good example. Because, I mean, what was more Theory ridiculous?
Yeah, so are you related to the Grossinger Hotel thing?
Yeah, you're the second person to ask me that tonight. My book, Out of Babylon, which I'm rewriting now, is very much about that. I am related, but my mother left my father when I was 1 year old and raised me in New York City with my stepfather. And until I was 9, I thought he was my father. And I had his last name. I was Richard Towers. He had changed it from Turetsky to Towers. And I took on my legal father's name and began to go to Grossinger's, and it became a big part of my life, and I've written about it extensively, and including in New Moon, that book there.
Well, I had taken a Kabbalah workshop in Accord, New York, and I used to go back to New York City or over New Paltz. There was a mountain over to New Paltz, and one day I went the other way toward the highway, and I passed this round hotel in the leaves of this big lawn, and I knew that was...
It's a ruin. Grossinger's is a ruin.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also found out in my 30s that my mother had me by an affair, so I wasn't even biologically related to them. But so I am connected, but in an odd way. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Or?
This is sort of a bibliographical question. Before the Nadir at Caltech with Kelly, had you already published all of his books and Enslin's books, or did that come
after? Yeah, before.
Okay. And did you ever work with Ram Dass?
No, the only time I ever met Ram Dass was fairly recently on the beach in Maui.
Okay.
With the Shigun author of our press, Kumar Francis,
who lived with him in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him at times, but that's the only time I met him, and this was after his stroke when he was living in Maui. Mm-hmm. We can just sort of talk. And thank you, everybody, for coming.
Well, thank you.
It's the last time I was looking for the recipe for vegetarian chopped liver, because I used to see the DNA theory, and where it was in the
right, which she didn't really write. I mean, somebody else
Every so, what do you?
Back in the day, you know, when I was reading your stuff, I read all the old memoir material. I don't know how I got to it. Myself, I was in the military and exited the military for Eugene. Which was like,
I started to use